Chapter 14. There was such a very smart official in attendance at the cemetery, where the little Cicerone had buried his children, that when the little Cicerone suggested to me, in a whisper, that there would be no offense in presenting this officer, in return for some slight extra service, with a couple of pals about 10 pence, English money, I looked incredulously at his cocked hat, wash leather gloves, well-made uniform, and dazzling buttons, and rebuked the little Cicerone with a grave shake of the head. For, in splendor of appearance, he was at least equal to the deputy usher of the Black Rod, and the idea of his carrying, as Jeremy Diddler would say, such a thing as 10 pence away with him, seemed monstrous. He took it in excellent part, however, when I made bold to give it him, and pulled off his cocked hat with a flourish that would have been a bargain at double the money. It seemed to be his duty to describe the monuments to the people at all events he was doing so, and when I compared him, like Gulliver in Brobdingnag, with the institutions of my own beloved country, I could not refrain from tears of pride and exultation. Apostrophe, he had no pace at all, no more than a tortoise. He loitered as the people loitered, that they might gratify their curiosity, and positively allowed them, now and then, to read the inscriptions on the tombs. He was neither shabby, nor insolent, nor churlish, nor ignorant. He spoke his own language with perfect propriety, and seemed to consider himself, in his way, a kind of teacher of the people, and to entertain a just respect both for himself and them. They would no more have such a man for a verger in Westminster Abbey, than they would let the people in, as they do at Bologna, to see the monuments for nothing. Two, again, an ancient somber town, under the brilliant sky, with heavy arcades over the footways of the older streets, and lighter and more cheerful archways in the newer portions of the town. Again, brown piles of sacred buildings, with more birds flying in, and out of chinks in the stones, and more snarling monsters for the bases of the pillars. Again, rich churches, drowsy masses, curling incense, tinkling bells, priests in bright vestments. Pictures, tapers, laced altar cloths, crosses, images, and artificial flowers. There is a grave and learned air about the city, and a pleasant gloom upon it, that would leave it, a distinct and separate impression in the mind, among a crowd of cities, though it were not still further marked in the traveler's remembrance by the two brick-leaning towers, sufficiently unsightly in themselves, it must be acknowledged, inclining crosswise, as if they were bowing stiffly to each other, a most extraordinary termination to the perspective of some of the narrow streets. The colleges, and churches too, and palaces. And above all the Academy of Fine Arts, where there are a host of interesting pictures, especially by Guido, Domenichino, and Ludovico Carracci. Give it a place of its own in the memory. Even though these were not, and there were nothing else to remember it by, the great meridian on the pavement of the Church of San Petronio, where the sunbeams mark the time among the kneeling people, would give it a fanciful and pleasant interest. Bologna, being very full of tourists, detained there by an inundation which rendered the road to Florence impassable, I was quartered up at the top of an hotel, in an out-of-the-way room which I never could find, containing a bed, big enough for a boarding school, which I couldn't fall asleep in. The chief among the waiters who visited this lonely retreat, where there was no other company but the swallows in the broad eaves over the window, was a man of one idea in connection with the English, and the subject of this harmless monomania was Lord Byron. I made the discovery by accidentally remarking to him, at breakfast, that the matting with which the floor was covered was very comfortable at that season, when he immediately replied that Myler Byron had been much attached to that kind of matting. Observing, at the same moment, that I took no milk, he exclaimed with enthusiasm, that Myler Byron had never touched it. At first, I took it for granted, in my innocence, that he had been one of the Byron servants. But no, he He said, no, he was in the habit of speaking about my lord to English gentlemen. That was all. He knew all about him, he said. In proof of it, he connected him with every possible topic, from the Montepulciano wine at dinner which was grown on an estate he had owned, to the big bed itself, which was the very model of his. When I left the inn, he coupled with his final bow in the yard, a parting assurance, that the road by which I was going, had been Myler Beeren's favorite ride. And before the horse's feet had well begun to clatter on the pavement, he ran briskly upstairs again, I dare say to tell some other Englishman in some other solitary room, that the guest who had just departed was Lord Beeren's living image. I had entered Bologna by night almost midnight, and all along the road thither, after our entrance into the papal territory, which is not, in any part, supremely well governed, St. Peter's keys being rather rusty now, the driver had so worried about the danger of robbers in traveling after dark, and had so infected the brave courier, and the two had been so constantly stopping, and getting up and down to look after a portmanteau which was tied on behind, that I should have felt almost obliged to anyone who would have had the goodness to take it away. Hence it was stipulated that, whenever we left Bologna, we should start so as not to arrive at Ferrara later than 8 at night, and a delightful afternoon and evening journey it was, albeit through a flat district which gradually became more marshy from the overflow of brooks and rivers in the recent heavy rains. At sunset, when I was walking on alone, while the horses rested, I arrived upon a little scene, which, by one of those singular mental operations, of which we are all conscious, seemed perfectly familiar to me, and which I see distinctly now. There was not much in it. In the blood-red light, there was a mournful sheet of water, just stirred by the evening wind, upon its margin a few trees. In the foreground, was a group of silent peasant girls leaning over the parapet of a little bridge, and looking, now up at the sky, now down into the water, in the distance, a deep bell, the shade of approaching night on everything. If I had been murdered there, in some former life, I could not have seemed to remember the place more thoroughly, or with a more emphatic chilling of the blood. And the mere remembrance of it acquired in that minute is so strengthened by the imaginary recollection that I hardly think I could forget it. More solitary, more depopulated, more deserted old Ferrara than any city of the solemn brotherhood. The grass so grows up in the silent streets that anyone might make hay there, literally, while the sun shines. But the sun shines with diminished cheerfulness in grim Ferrara. And the people are so few who pass, and repass through the places, that the flesh of its inhabitants might be grass indeed, and growing in the squares. I wonder why the head coppersmith in an Italian town always lives next door to the hotel, or opposite, making the visitor feel as if the beating hammers were his own heart, palpitating with a deadly energy. I wonder why jealous corridors surround the bedroom on all sides, and fill it with unnecessary doors, that can't be shut, and will not open, and abut on pitchy darkness. I wonder why it is not enough, that these distrustful genii stand agape at one's dreams all night, but there must also be round open portholes, high in the wall, suggestive, when a mouse or rat is heard behind the wainscot, of a somebody scraping the wall with his toes, in his endeavors to reach one of these portholes and look in. I wonder why the faggots are so constructed, as to know of no effect, but an agony of heat, when they are lighted and replenished, and an agony of cold and suffocation at all other times. I wonder, above all, why it is the great feature of domestic architecture in Italian inns, that all the fire goes up the chimney, except the smoke. The answer matters little. Coppersmiths, doors, portholes, smoke, and faggots, are welcome to me. Give me the smiling face of the attendant, man or woman, the courteous manner, the amiable desire to please, and to be pleased, the light-hearted, pleasant, simple air, so many jewels set in dirt, and I am theirs again tomorrow. Ariosto's house, Tasso's prison, a rare old Gothic cathedral, and more churches, of course, are the sites of Ferrara. But the long silent streets, and the dismantled palaces, where ivy waves in lieu of banners, and where rank weeds are slowly creeping up the long untrodden stairs, are the best sights of all. The aspect of this dreary town, half an hour before sunrise one fine morning, when I left it, was as picturesque as it seemed unreal and spectral. It was no matter that the people were not yet out of bed. For if they had all been up and busy, they would have made but little difference in that desert of a place. It was best to see it, without a single figure in the picture, a city of the dead, without one solitary survivor. Pestilence might have ravaged streets, squares, and marketplaces, and sack and siege have ruined the old houses, battered down their doors and windows, and made breaches in their roofs. In one part, a great tower rose into the air, the only landmark in the melancholy view. In another, a prodigious castle, with a moat about it, stood aloof. A sullen city in itself. In the black dungeons of this castle, Parisina and her lover were beheaded in the dead of night. The red light, beginning to shine when I looked back upon it, stained its walls without, as they have, many a time, been stained within, in old days, but for any sign of life they gave, the castle and the city might have been avoided by all human creatures, from the moment when the axe went down upon the last of the two lovers, and might have never vibrated to another sound, beyond the blow, that to the block pierced through with forced and sullen shock. Coming to the Po, which was greatly swollen, and running fiercely, we crossed it by a floating bridge of boats, and so came into the Austrian territory, and resumed our journey. Through a country of which, for some miles, a great part was under water. The brave courier and the soldier he had first quarreled, for half an hour or more, over our eternal passport. But this was a daily relaxation with the brave, who was always stricken deaf, when shabby functionaries in uniform came, as they constantly did come, plunging out of wooden boxes, to look at it or in other words to beg, and who, stone deaf to my entreaties, that the man might have a trifle given him, and we resume our journey in peace, was wont to sit reviling the functionary in broken English. While the unfortunate man's face was a portrait of mental agony framed in the coach window, from his perfect ignorance of what was being said to his disparagement. There was a postillion, in the course of this day's journey, as wild and savagely good-looking a vagabond as you would desire to see. He was a tall, stout-made, dark-complexioned fellow, with a profusion of shaggy black hair hanging all over his face, and great black whiskers stretching down his throat. His dress was a torn suit of rifle green, garnished here and there with red. A steeple-crowned hat, innocent of nap, with a broken and bedraggled feather stuck in the band, and a flaming red neckerchief hanging on his shoulders. He was not in the saddle, but reposed, quite at his ease, on a sort of low footboard in front of the postchaise, down amongst the horses' tails convenient for having his brains kicked out at any moment. To this brigand, the brave courier, when we were at a reasonable trot, happened to suggest the practicability of going faster. He received the proposal with a perfect yell of derision, brandished his whip about his head, such a whip, it was more like a homemade bow, flung up his heels, much higher than the horses, and disappeared, in a paroxysm, somewhere in the neighborhood of the axle tree. I fully expected to see him lying in the road, 100 yards behind, but up came the steeple-crowned hat again, next minute, and he was seen reposing, as on the sofa, entertaining himself with the idea, and crying, ha, ha, what next? Oh the devil! Faster too! Shoo-hoo-oh-oh! Apostrophe this last ejaculation, an inexpressibly defiant hoot. Being anxious to reach our immediate destination that night, I ventured, by and by, to repeat the experiment on my own account. It produced exactly the same effect. Round flew the whip with the same scornful flourish, Up came the heels, down went the steeple-crowned hat, and presently he reappeared, reposing as before and saying to himself, Ha ha! What next? Faster too! Oh the devil! Shoo-hoo-oh-oh! Apostrophe! Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.